Greetings and Manifestian ramifications, my plutarctically pernidian listeners, and welcome to this February 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this rapscallion-filled science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Hi, hello, how are ya? You may be either pleased or likewise not so pleased that this month there is no individual idiot scientist of the month. However, on the other hand, I am giving the award to the entire Center for Disease Control of the U.S. instead. This is one of the worst flu seasons here in the U.S. in the last 25 years, and if you Americans out there did not know it, our dear friends at the CDC are responsible for picking out what flu viruses are going to be most prevalent in a year. They choose the most likely viruses, and the production of all the vaccines is geared toward those specific strains. Well, I did not know that this process of choosing influenza viruses was apparently done by throwing darts at a board. At least you would think that, based on the fact that the American public has been told three horrific things. First, the flu vaccines this year are only about 10% effective. What? What does that mean? Well, put simply, it means you will not become immunologically resistant to 9 out of 10 flu strains that you will probably come into contact with if you are vaccinated. Second horrible thing, because so few flu viruses are covered by the vaccine, you may be in danger of getting flu twice or more even this year. Why? Because statistically, if you contract one of those 9 strains that you are sensitive to, you may get better and then catch one of the other 8 that you're still sensitive to contracting. Thank you, CDC. What does the CDC say to this? Quote, everyone should continue to get their annual flu vaccine. Some protection against H3N2 viruses is better than nothing. And other components of the vaccine like H1N1 and influenza B may likely provide additional protection this year. Unquote. So, what is the third horrific thing? Is relatively innocuous influenza B the predominant strain out there this year? Heck no! It's the pathogenically dangerous influenza strain A. The vaccine is not protecting the population here, and this strain is becoming a serious health hazard in the U.S. Nationally, here in the States, there have been more than 50 influenza-associated pediatric deaths reported during the 2017-2018 flu season so far, and the exact number is difficult to pin down since some cases are reported by family and not necessarily tabulated in the official CDC count until the autopsies are performed. Ugh. So to conclude, yes, the CDC, due to their stellar procedures in protecting the population from influenza, deserves the Idiot Scientists of the Month Award. I just hope you guys around the rest of the world are doing better. So here are 2 flu-related stories that suggest how the world may soon not have to worry about yearly flu seasons and how we may be better protected in the future. First, a new way of killing viruses and pathogenic bacteria in public places before they can even infect you. Dr. David Brenner, professor at Columbia University, published a story last week in the journal Scientific Reports, which suggests that a new type of light may be able to protect us from all sorts of microorganisms that would love to make us their dinner. Brenner's team found that continuous low doses of what he called far ultraviolet C, or far UVC, can kill airborne flu viruses without harming human tissues. His paper suggests that use of overhead far UVC lights in hospitals, doctors' offices, schools, airports, airplanes, and other public spaces could provide powerful checks on seasonal influenza epidemics, as well as influenza pandemics. We've known for decades that broad-spectrum UV light is really, really good at killing bacteria and viruses. It destroys the molecular bonds that hold the DNA together. And this conventional UV light is routinely used to decontaminate surgical equipment. In fact, I have UV lamps in my own lab, which I sometimes turn on at the end of a workday to be left on all night. It reduces bacterial contamination by quite a bit in our tissue culture work. You do not want to leave these things on during the day, though. Not good. You cannot expose people to this light. Although it works as a germicidal, it also causes skin cancer and cataracts in exposed humans. Well, Brenner hypothesized that a narrow spectrum of ultraviolet light called far UVC could kill microbes without damaging healthy tissue. In fact, he demonstrated that far UVC light was effective at killing MRSA, that's methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. Really nasty stuff. It's a common cause of surgical wound infections, but apparently he was able to kill this off without harming human or mouse skin on which he was testing this. Brenner says, quote, far UVC light has a very limited range and cannot penetrate through the outer dead cell layer of human skin or the tear layer in the eye, so it's not a human health hazard. But because viruses and bacteria are so much smaller than human cells, far UVC light can reach their DNA and kill them, unquote. Influenza virus spreads from person to person mainly through fine liquid droplets or aerosols. These become airborne when people with the flu cough or sneeze or just talk, in fact. The current study was designed to test if far UVC light could efficiently kill these aerosolized influenza viruses in the air in a setting similar to a public space. In his study, aerosolized H1N1 virus, which is a common strain of flu, was released into a test chamber and exposed at very low doses at 222 nanometers far UVC light. A control group of aerosolized virus was not exposed to the UVC light. The far UVC light efficiently inactivated the flu viruses with about the same efficiency as conventional germicidal UV light. So it was just as good as the really nasty stuff. And it kind of reminds me of that old episode of Star Trek in which they end up blinding Spock accidentally, trying to treat him for an infected parasite. They do that with light as bright as the sun when they only needed one little non-blinding wavelength to kill the infection. Anyway, Brenner writes, quote, we are extremely excited at the prospect of this new process. Continuous very low dose rate far UVC light in indoor public locations is a promising, safe, and inexpensive tool to reduce the spread of airborne mediated microbial diseases. At the price of less than $1,000 per lamp, a cost that would surely decrease if the lamps were mass-produced, far UVC lights are relatively inexpensive. Lower prices could lead to potentially wide-sweeping impacts toward diminishing the spread of many infectious diseases. Unquote. This is all great news. But another story came out last month that may have just as important an impact on flu pandemics as that. Maybe even more. Okay, so the CDC's big problem this year was that they did not guess which flu strains would be the most common. Well, what if that guessing was all a thing of the past, and you could get complete coverage for all flu strains with a single injection? Well, that may actually happen soon. Dr. Baozong Wang of Georgia State is helping to design a new type of flu vaccine that is universal in nature. His January paper in Nature Communications covers his breakthrough. Again, going back to the CDC, seasonal flu vaccines provide protective immunity against influenza viruses by targeting the exterior head of the virus's surface protein. The main protein that's targeted is something called hemagglutinin. The influenza virus trains the body to produce antibodies against inactivated virus particles containing the head with this protein, ideally preventing the head from attaching to receptors and stopping infection. However, this head of the virus is highly variable and is different for each virus, creating a need for better vaccines. This study uses a new approach and instead targets the inside portion of the hemagglutinin protein known as the stalk, which is more conservative and offers the opportunity for universal protection. Wang says, quote, we're trying to develop a new vaccine approach that eliminates the need for vaccination every year. We're developing a universal flu vaccine. You wouldn't need to change the vaccine type every year because it's universal and can protect you against any influenza virus. One injection would last for years. Unquote. What Wang wanted to do was induce immunological response to the stalk part of the protein and not the head part. That's why you're protected against different viruses, because all influenza viruses share the stalk domain, even though the other part of the protein is not shared and it varies from virus to virus. Unfortunately, the stalk domain part of the virus isn't very stable. So we used a very special way to make this vaccine construct with the stalk domain, and he was successful at it. Wang says that his group fabricated protein nanoparticles approximately the size of the influenza A, with a core displaying a shell of conserved hemagglutinin protein domains. The binding of soluble hemagglutinin to the undissolved nanoparticles is speculated to be mediated through interaction of hydrophobic residues. That's areas that don't mix well with water. Wang states, quote, "To our knowledge, this design avoids the risk of instability shown by virus-like particles under osmotic stresses or during changes in salt concentration, and prevents off-target immune responses against self-assembly motifs such as ferritin or hepatitis B core protein used in some designs." Unquote. The nanoparticle protects antigenic proteins so that they won't be degraded. Immune cells apparently do not have too much difficulty in taking in the nanoparticle, so the particle is much, much better than a soluble protein at inducing immune responses. To determine the effectiveness of the nanoparticle vaccine, the researchers immunized mice twice with an intramuscular shot. Then, the mice were exposed to several different influenza viruses, H1N1, H3N2, H5N1, and H7N9. Immunization provided universal complete protection against lethal virus exposure and dramatically reduced the amount of virus in the lungs for these infected mice. Next, the researchers would like to test the nanoparticle vaccine on ferrets. I know, ferrets? Why ferrets? Well, strangely enough, ferrets are similar to humans in how their immune systems work and how their respiratory systems work. Who'd have thunk? Anyway, from ferrets, they will go on in the future with long-term testing in humans. If it turns out successfully, we can tell our friends at the CDC to forget about flu permanently and worry about some more serious plagues that may be out there. Okay, next stories. I did say stories. The next two stories represent the glut of stuff out there on Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases that make me a bit nuts sometimes. I have mentioned three different studies in the past that suggest wine, grape juice, or just eating plain grapes has been suggested as a way to stave off and reduce the probability of getting Alzheimer's. And I can see the scientific basis for that work, so I have more or less accepted it. And apparently more of this stuff comes out month to month, and a lot of these stories I just entirely miss. Well, here are two nutritionally based studies that have opposite conclusions. First, last month's study from Nature Neuroscience entitled, quote, "Dietary salt promotes neurovascular and cognitive dysfunction through a gut-initiated Th17 response," unquote. This study suggests that too much salt in your diet will increase your chances for dementia. The study was performed by Dr. Constantino Iadecola at the Weill Cornell Medicine Institute. To investigate the effects of dietary salt more closely, Iadecola fed mice a diet containing either 4 or 8% salt, representing an 8-fold and a 16-fold increase, respectively, of the normal mouse diet. The salt content of the mouse diets was equivalent to the upper end of the human dietary salt consumption. After 8 weeks MRI studies of the mouse brains identified a 28% decrease in the resting blood flow in the cortex and a 25% decrease in blood flow to the hippocampus, two areas of the brain that are involved in learning. The high salt also hindered brain endothelial cells from producing nitric oxide, which normally acts to relax the blood vessels and increase blood flow. There was little evidence of any vasculatory inflammatory effect that may have caused the endothelial dysfunction. It makes sense that normal cognitive function requires well-regulated blood flow. Ida Kola found that mice kept on high-salt diets developed dementia and performed worse on a whole series of tests, including object recognition tests and a maze test. Switching the animals back onto a normal diet resulted in improved performance on the novel object recognition test. A high-salt diet also affected normal nesting behavior, with high-salt-fed mice using less nesting material and demonstrating impaired nest-building abilities. Great, so now I need to cut down on my salt in my diet, or I'll turn into a cabbage head. Well, that's lovely. Anything good on the horizon then? Well, it turns out that the second study suggests another dietary change that may help you. If you drink alcohol moderately, say a couple of glasses of wine or a couple of shots of whiskey a day, you may want to toast your glymphatic system. What is the glymphatic system? Well, it helps to clear your brain of metabolites, including the proteins that are associated with Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. According to new research from the University of Rochester, the glymphatic system may work better if you consume low amounts of alcohol. Be advised, kiddies. This is not your license to become bacchanalian drunken idiots. There is a limit here. The glymphatic system will perform more poorly if you drink too much alcohol. When animals are exposed to high levels of alcohol over a low period of time, the University of Rochester scientists observed markers of inflammation that rose in their brains. Also, the animals suffered impaired cognition and motor skills. So the paper was published February 2nd in the latest issue of the journal Scientific Reports, and it is entitled, quote, "Beneficial Effects of Low Alcohol Exposure, but Adverse Effects of High Alcohol Intake on Glymphatic Function," unquote. The article describes the effects of acute and chronic ethanol exposure and withdrawal from chronic ethanol exposure on glymphatic function. Remember, glymphatic function is a brain-wide metabolite clearance system connected to the peripheral lymphatic system. Author Dr. Macon Nedergaard of the University of Rochester Medical Center states, quote, "Prolonged intake of excessive amounts of ethanol is known to have adverse effects on the CNS, central nervous system. However, in the study, we have shown for the first time that low doses of alcohol are potentially beneficial to brain health, namely, it improves the abilities brain to remove waste," unquote. The new study adds to a growing body of research that point to the health benefits of low doses of alcohol. While excessive consumption of alcohol has been well documented for years, many studies have linked low levels of drinking with a reduced risk of cardiovascular disease as well as cancer. Nedergaard focuses on the glymphatic system, the brain's unique cleaning process, and he was able to show how cerebral spinal fluid is pumped into brain tissue and flushes away waste. And that waste includes proteins like beta amyloids and tau that are associated with Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. Nedergaard in the paper says, quote, "Surprisingly, glymphatic function increased in mice treated with 0.5 grams per kilogram, that is low-dose ethanol, following acute exposure, as well as after 1 month of chronic exposure. Low doses of chronic ethanol intake were associated with significant decreases in GFAP expression with little change in the cytokine profile compared with the saline-treated group," unquote. Animals that were exposed to low levels of alcohol analogous to approximately 2.5 drinks a day, actually showed less inflammation in the brain. The low-dose animals' performance in cognitive and motor tests were identical to controls. Nedergaard finishes with, quote, "The data on the effects of alcohol on the glymphatic system seemingly matched the J-shaped model relating to the dose effects of alcohol on general health and mortality, whereby low doses of alcohol are beneficial, while excessive consumption is detrimental to overall health." Unquote. I find this entire story really interesting because I just had a conversation about this with the Concho, the leader of my dojo, the other night. He told me he had a 98-year-old great uncle who has been having a beer, a shot of whiskey, and a shot of sherry every day for the last 80 years. By the way, that stays within the guidelines of Nedergaard's study. Anyway, apparently, the old guy's family complained to his doctor that he needed to stop drinking so much, quote-unquote, because it was not good for him at his age. And the doctor allegedly turned on the younger family members and took them to task for being incredibly silly. He told them to leave the old uncle alone since whatever he was doing was working for him. And you don't tell a 98-year-old man to change a lifetime of habits. Next story. Botox seems to be jumping species. Wow, that sounds like it could be a serious problem. When not used to stiffen muscles and smooth out wrinkles on your face, botulinum toxin is regarded as one of the deadliest substances on the face of the earth. How deadly? Well, it is used as a biological weapon by many nation states, and 100 nanograms, that is a 100 billionths of a gram, will kill half of the humans exposed to it. Nasty as that sounds, as far as Botox being dangerous in the real world outside of a Tom Clancy story, there has been only one place to be accidentally poisoned by it, and that is by the bacteria Clostridium botulinum, which is mostly associated with foodborne illness. Since Clostridium is a bacteria that doesn't like oxygen very much, that has pretty much protected us against general outbreaks and poisonings. It doesn't grow in most places very well, and certainly not out in the open. Well now, a Harvard team of investigators have discovered botulinum toxin in a strain of Enterococcus. So what's Enterococcus? Well, that's a bacteria that thrives in the gastrointestinal tracts of nearly all land animals. Yes, that includes the human gut. The Harvard team isolated the Botox-carrying bacterial strain from cow feces sampled at a South Carolina farm. The paper was published last month in the journal Cell Host Microbe. Lead author Dr. Min Dong says, quote, "This is the first time a botulinum neurotoxin has been found outside of Clostridium botulinum. And not just the toxin, but the entire unit containing the toxin and associated proteins that prevent the toxin from being degraded in the GI tract," unquote. Okay, so this is terrifying. But it's not as terrifying as it could be. The enterococcal isolate carrying the toxin luckily remains susceptible to key antibiotics, and it was found only once from a single animal, and no signs of botulism disease were observed in that cow. When the research team tested the toxin in rodents in the lab, it seemed to have little or no effect. It was only when they manipulated the toxin to better target the mouse and rat neurons that it became potent, shutting down nerve function and causing paralysis in the poor rodents. The researchers are currently testing the new Botox on cultured neurons to determine if it's toxin to humans. The ability to swap genes is what worried the researchers the most. Could a potent toxin from Clostridium end up in a multi-drug-resistant human strain of bacteria? Many investigators now seem to think that it is at least theoretically possible, and that would be very, very bad. Dong says, quote, "Enterococcus is a central hub for gene transfer within the gut, and that makes it potentially scary," unquote. Once again, this all sounds like something that Michael Crichton might write about. Okay, last story of the night. It's an exoplanet update. What we've all been waiting for. Still too early to pack your bags for the star TRAPPIST-1, but two new studies probe the likely compositions of the seven Earth-sized worlds orbiting this cool, dim star, and some are looking better and better as places to live. New mass measurements suggest that the group of seven planets probably have rocky surfaces and possibly thin atmospheres. Researchers reported all this February 5th in the Journal of Astronomy and Astrophysics. For at least three of the planets, those atmospheres don't appear to be too hot for life to form. TRAPPIST-1 is about 40 light-years from Earth, and four of its planets lie within or near the habitable zone, the range where temperatures can sustain liquid water. That makes these worlds tempting targets in the search for extraterrestrial life. One clue to potential habitability is a planet's mass, something not precisely nailed down in previous measurements of the TRAPPIST-1 world. Mass helps to determine a planet's density, which in turn provides clues to its makeup. High density could indicate that a planet doesn't have an atmosphere. Low density could indicate that a planet is shrouded in a puffy, hydrogen-rich atmosphere that could cause a runaway greenhouse effect. Using new computer techniques that account for the planet's gravitational tugs on each other, Dr. Simon Grimm of the University of Bern calculated the seven planets' masses with 5 to 8 times better precision than ever before. Grimm says, quote, "Our measurements suggest that the innermost planet probably has a thick, viscous atmosphere like Venus. The other six, which may be covered in ice or oceans, may have more life-friendly atmospheres. The fourth planet from the star has the same density as Earth and receives the same amount of radiation from its star as Earth does. And that's the really cool thing. We have one planet which is very, very similar to Earth," unquote. Having an atmosphere could suggest habitability, but not if it's too hot. So using the Hubble Space Telescope, Grimm's team observed the four middle planets as they pass in front of the star. They looked for a signature in the near-infrared wavelengths of light filtering through the planet's atmospheres. That would have indicated that the atmospheres were full of heat-trapping hydrogen. In four different observations, the Hubble telescope saw no sign of these hydrogen-rich atmospheres around three of the worlds, and they ruled out one of the scenarios that would have made the planets uninhabitable by doing this. Well, we'll find out more about those seven planets of TRAPPIST-1 when the replacement for the Hubble telescope launches next year. Yes, in 2019, the James Webb Space Telescope will be placed out there in orbit, and it will be powerful enough to figure out all the components of those planets' atmospheres, if those atmospheres actually exist. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Drink that little nip of alcohol, but not more. And keep away from drinking salt water, I guess. And keep watching the skies, especially near TRAPPIST-1. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.